The political decisions in the federal government are supposed to be made by the executive and legislative branches, but the judicial branch, especially the Supreme Court, looms larger and larger as a political or at least politicized entity over time. Today's guest covers the court and gives us an analysis of the people and the cases that were the big deals of the Supreme Court's last session. The analysis comes in the book American Justice 2014, Nine Clashing Visions on the Supreme Court. Garrett Epps is the author. He's a professor of law at the University of Baltimore and a contributing writer for The Atlantic and The American Prospect. His previous book is American Epic, Reading the U.S. Constitution. Garrett Epps, thanks for joining us today in The Exchange.
Glad to be here.
Your career path is really interesting. You did the whole journalist thing and then went to law school. Tell us about what motivated that.
Well, I think if you look around the field of journalism today, you'll see that the opportunities for people at my stage of my career are fairly limited. Most of the major websites and outlets are being staffed by young people who can work for very little. And on the other hand, you know, gray hairs in a lawyer are considered to be an asset. So
that's a nice difference.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, as one of the owners of the few gray heads left in journalism, I can appreciate that.
Yeah.
Was the 2013-14 Supreme Court session practically screaming for a book to be written about it? And I'm curious about the genesis of the project.
Well, the University of Pennsylvania Press actually came to me and asked me. They want to start a series of books about each term and with a different author each time and probably a different concept, and said, would I like to do it? And the main intent of this book was as an e-book, although it's now selling reasonably well as a physical book. I'd never written an e-book, and I thought, why not? So, you know, that's where it came from. Now, at the time, you know, we didn't know whether that would be a big term or not, and in certain senses, the last term was not as big as the term before it. It may not be as big as this term, but there was plenty of important stuff to write about, and I learned a great deal about how the court works and about the justices in the process, even though I'd already been covering the court for 4 years, so I'm glad I took it on.
Well, you do a good job, I should say, of peeling back some of the layers of misunderstanding that often come and getting us to understand the court just a whole lot better, step by step. I'm struck by one of the things you bring to light, though, the idea that the court has no intention. So you're saying it really doesn't know, I mean, the members really don't know up front where they're going?
I think some of them have a sense of where they'd like to be in 5 years, where they'd like the law to be in 10 years. But, of course, events have a way of getting between them and that objective, and each justice, even the Chief Justice, is only one vote out of nine. So it's almost like a series of choices being made by people who can only respond to what is before them at that moment. And when you look back over a 5 or 10 year period, this is the 10th year of the Roberts Court, you begin to see a character. You begin to see a direction. But I don't think it's anybody's design. I think each of them is just trying to do the best they can with what comes in the inbox that day.
Okay, that was an important concept you gave us just a moment ago, though. There's some members of the court do know where they'd like the law to be in 5 years. So is it a case of wanting things to happen a certain way and helping to choose cases that will allow that direction to be taken through decision? Or is it, I mean, I guess I still think that a lot of us would like to think that the justices respond to what's put before them and use the law that exists.
Well, I think anyone who gets on the United States Supreme Court has devoted a life to the law, has thought very hard about it, and has some pretty firm opinions about what the Constitution should say, how statutes should be read, what the role of the federal government should be. And it's very hard to think of any of them just purely as passive receptacles of the court's inbox. I think some of them have more strategic sense than others. And certainly the Chief Justice Roberts, who can look forward to 20 to 25 years in office, has a sense of where he would like the law to go. And I think he pursues it systematically, one step at a time. I think you can contrast him with an older judge like Justice Scalia, who is facing really the end of his career now, 5 years, who knows, and the law has not gone where he wants yet, and he is eager to take giant steps, you know, to really do what would be called activism in certain cases, in order to have done what he wanted to do when he went on the bench at the time he leaves. So it's interesting to see those two pressures clash.
Are the choices of which cases to take politically motivated, do you think? Or is it purely just like, okay, we need to resolve this because the question needs to be answered?
It depends what you mean by politics. I think that most of the time the judges are thinking about whether, in their judgment, a given grant would make good law. Now, sometimes they have to take a case. If it's an important nationwide statute and the circuits are split, that's what they get paid for. Step in and settle that. Some of the time they don't. And I think you can see that the court has consistently denied cert in the same-sex marriage cases. Because some of the justices, I think, are afraid of where they will go.
All right. Much more to talk about with Garrett Epps. His book is American Justice 2014, Nine Clashing Visions on the Supreme Court. It goes case by case, justice by justice. So nine fairly tight chapters in there. We'll talk more with Garrett Epps and take your phone calls and emails on the Jefferson Exchange when we come back in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Garrett Epps, journalist and lawyer, and he is a professor of law at the University of Baltimore, a contributing writer for The Atlantic and The American Prospect, the author of a book about the Supreme Court in its last session called American Justice 2014, Nine Clashing Visions on the Supreme Court, nine chapters that go justice by justice and case by case. You can join us on the Exchange as we talk about the Supreme Court and its workings and some notable cases of recent years. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, same number, 800-838-3760, and our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. There is some history in here that goes earlier than just the year in question here, Garrett. And for example, you bring up the bitterness of the arguments over Brown versus Board of Education, which still ended up as a unanimous decision, didn't it?
It did, it's a fascinating example of how history could have been different, because Chief Justice Fred Vinson was really unable to produce a unified court. The court was unable to really decide the issue, and it seems most likely that if the case had been pushed to a conclusion during his final term as Chief Justice, the decision would have been to uphold Plessy versus Ferguson and uphold racial segregation in schools, and our history might be very different. Now, between terms, the Chief Justice died very suddenly. It was unexpected. Leading Justice Felix Frankfurter to remark to one of his clerks, this is the first indication I've ever had that there may be a God in heaven. Instead, Chief Justice Warren was named to the court, who arrived very much determined to eradicate this stain on American life, and with the political ability and the sheer determination to ensure that the decision was unanimous. And so a year later, we had 9-0 that school desegregation was unconstitutional. It's a very remarkable story.
But we know the backdrop to this from what? I mean, there are papers and records available from that time?
Absolutely. The Supreme Court operates, you know, on a sea of paper. By and large, the justices don't sit down and talk to each other, you know, the way we think or the way it's shown on you know, TV dramas, you know, where one will walk into another's office and say, how can I get your vote? They are very bookish lawyers. They communicate through memos and draft opinions, all of which go to the National Archives and eventually are made public, usually, you know, when a given justice indicates that it would be appropriate to make it public. So we have a huge record now of what was going on in the court then, and indeed, you know, as late as the 80s, the Thurgood Marshall papers have been made available And so we see, you know, how the justices work back and forth. And a generation from now, we'll be seeing that about this court.
So the point being that at this point in time, we don't really know the inner workings of the court, just the paper that actually is out there in the public.
Absolutely. And the court is determinedly opaque about its reasons. When the court denies cert in a case, we do not get a summary of who voted how. When the court grants cert, we do not get a summary of who voted how. And so, you know, we can only guess at not only why things are being done, but who are actually doing them.
Your admiration and maybe even love, if it's not too strong a word, for the Constitution and law is clear in your own writing in the book. I'm curious to know, and you do point out your opinions on some of the opinions that the Supreme Court came down with, not hiding the ball, as you say. But just in general, would you term yourself either an originalist or a living document kind of guy?
Well, you know, I kind of try to get past that distinction, because I think when people say the Constitution is a living document, they have in mind, you know, this concept that has been sold to the public very successfully since the Reagan years, that a living Constitution means the judge just does whatever he wants. And I don't believe that is the case, and I don't believe it's appropriate if it were the case. I think the question really is whether the United States is a living nation or not. And I think that there are certain originalists who regard the Constitution as, you know, what a insect collector would call a killing jar, something you put over something alive in order to kill it and preserve it on a piece of paper. And the idea being that the Constitution somehow was designed to prevent the United States from changing and becoming a modern country, which I think historically is simply demonstrably false, that the framers of the Constitution
really hoped the country would prosper and become bigger and stronger and modernize in ways that they didn't foresee. So I see the Constitution as a set of rules for a living country so that we can govern ourselves and not kill each other and resolve our problems and in a way that basically everyone feels they got a fair shake. And I think if you think about it that way, the question of living, you know, living or not living, it becomes much less important, because we all understand about rules, rules of a game, rules of a system. And if you think the Constitution is not there to tell us what policies to follow, it's there to tell us how to settle disputes about policy, I think it makes a lot more sense.
It's the boundary lines on the field, in a sense, and not much
exactly.
More than that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Garrett Epps, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is American Justice 2014, Nine Clashing Visions on the Supreme Court. You do, in fact, let people know where you stand on some of the cases, and I want to come back to Citizens United as a prelude to getting into McCutcheon versus FEC. What were your thoughts about the legal reasoning used in Citizens United?
Well, I think there are a couple of criticisms I would make of Citizens United. They are not, I think, the ones that people are accustomed to make in the media. I don't think the problem with Citizens United is that somehow the court said corporations are people. It didn't. I don't think the problem with Citizens United is that corporations shouldn't have free speech rights. I don't think that's even what the case is about. I think, you know, the first criticism you could make of this case is that the court really didn't need to make such a broad decision. The facts of the case that came before it were such that the court could have made a much narrower decision and left the issue to be developed more fully and more briefed more fully by the parties than it was in the Citizens United case. I think the other concern that people have about Citizens United that carries over to McCutcheon, which is the case from last term, is that the court's idea that corruption really only means exchange of money for favors, so that if a rich person or corporation spends millions of dollars on behalf of a politician, there's no corruption unless they say, we are going to do this in exchange for your vote. Whereas I think the ordinary person, the ordinary player in our political system, feels, you know, very intuitively that a system where candidates are dependent on rich donors and rich independent groups is going to be one where politicians are not able to make independent judgments on issues, and governmental power
passes informally, at least, into the hands of very rich people, and that is a corrupt system. Ordinary people think of that as meaning corruption, and I think that intuition is correct. So I think the court, for reasons of its own, adopted this narrow view of corruption, and it has led us astray in the campaign finance area.
It looks like our first couple of calls want to talk about that very subject area. Garrett Epps is our guest. His book is American Justice 2014. Our phone number is 800-838-3760. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Phil in Central Point. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yeah, thanks so much for taking my call. And Mr. Epps, I really appreciate you, saying a bit about corruption in our system. And I believe something that definitely needs to be done about this. And I was curious what your opinion was on the Article 5 convention process for the states to essentially overrule the Supreme Court and the federal government to pass U.S. amendments, U.S. amendments to the Constitution, to say counteract Citizens United and such decisions, and eliminate, corporate union private financing of campaigns nationwide.
All right, so constitutional convention in Article 5. What do you think about that, Garrett?
Well, I have two answers. I think the Article 5 process is something we should use, and that covers all the ways that the Constitution can be amended. And I am very much interested in and sympathetic to the movements to try to amend the Constitution by means of legislative action to limit the bad effects of Citizens United. I have to tell you, I'm a little nervous about Article 5 conventions, because once we open up the system to an Article 5 convention, it's entirely possible that body would run away and simply write a new constitution. That, in fact, is how the current constitution got written. It was written by a convention that had no legal permission to do it, but they just said, we need a new one, we're going to write a new one, and we don't care that we don't have the legal warrant to do it, and then we're going to really make noise until it's adopted. I think if you think about what an Article 5 convention would look like in the year 2014 or 15, it should give you pause, because, first of all, the delegates will be elected, and those elections, of course, will be governed by the same campaign finance rules that we're very troubled by, so that the Koch brothers, I can guarantee you, the Koch brothers have already said publicly that they consider themselves the equivalent of the founding fathers. They will be flooding these statewide elections with money to get the people they want picked for the convention. The convention would then assemble in public view. Remember that the Philadelphia Convention was in secret, and that's the only reason they were able to write the Constitution that we have. But this will be in public view. The CNN trailers will be there. There'll be people hawking, popcorn and so forth. And we will then have the spectacle, that we have in Congress now, only more so, of people who really are not responsible for being reelected, not interested in being reelected, simply interested in carrying out their political beliefs. And there are, there are three possible outcomes. One is that it writes a new convention or a good constitution or a good set of amendments. That's one. The second is that it writes a really bad constitution, a really bad set of amendments. And the third is that it deadlocks. And if that happens, if the Constitution Convention continues to meet day after day and no one knows what's going to happen, we are looking at serious social instability in this country. We're looking, to begin with, in major fallout for the capital markets, because business does not like the idea that they don't know what the Constitution will look like 12 months hence. And as the convention deadlocks, as we don't know how long it's going to take, we begin to see a loss of confidence in the capital markets. We're going to begin to see social anger raise. And I think we are taking a big risk with our system by possibly opening everything up. Now, I don't want to say this, as I said at the beginning, I do not want to discourage citizens from working with the ordinary Article 5 process and pursuing specific amendments. We have seen state legislatures and localities responding to the outcry over Citizens United by passing resolutions and passing potential amendments, and I think that this will have a really good effect. Let's remember that Citizens United could be reversed, not by a constitutional amendment, but by an appointment to the court, because it was a 5-4 decision. The Constitution doesn't really need amending to correct it, because it's wrong. The Constitution doesn't say what the majority in that case said it said, and a subsequent case could relieve us of this problem.
Garrett Epps again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, his book American Justice 2014. Here's Steve in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Howdy, this is a pleasure. There's a question that has bothered me about the court for quite some time now. If corporations, that's the legal fiction, or I consider to be a fiction, that corporations are people. Unfortunately, that's the law of the land. Well, if a person is engaged in a criminal conspiracy, they're subject to all of their property being forfeited to the U.S. government and the RICO statute. Yet, if a corporation like Enron obviously is caught with its pants down in a criminal conspiracy, the government doesn't come in and take Pacific Power and Electric or you know, any of the other electric companies or oil companies or whatever.
So the point being that if they're going to be considered people, they need to have to suffer the consequences as well as enjoy the benefits. Thanks for that, Steve. And Garrett, what about that part, really going all the way on corporate personhood?
Well, I think people need to understand that corporations today are subject to indictment and prosecution under statutes, a wide variety of criminal statutes, including but not limited to RICO. You know, of course, their executives who engage in criminal activities are as well. So, you know, the legal paradox is not there. Now, Steve is correct to raise a concern that I have and that has been written about, which is that the Justice Department of the United States, and this is true under both parties, is more reluctant than I would like it to be to actually pursue maximum criminal penalties against corporations as such. And there is a saying that is...
Garrett, we're losing you around fabric or something.
Okay. There is a saying that is current in legal circles saying that corporations are, quote, too big to jail. And I think that that's a misperception on the part of the Justice Department, and I would like to see people like Steve bring some political pressure on our elected leaders, on the Justice Department, to take a more aggressive approach. You know, Senator Elizabeth Warren has been very outspoken about this, and there's no legal obstacle to going after these corporations as a whole, as well as after their executives.
Okay, again, the book American Justice 2014 goes chapter by chapter, 9 chapters, each with a case and a justice. So the second chapter, we just talked about John Roberts and McCutcheon versus FEC. Sonia Sotomayor and affirmative action. Has it gotten to the point where affirmative action cases before the court are generally down to claims of reverse discrimination?
Yes. I mean, that is really the doctrine. That has been the doctrine for a long time. The idea is that the 14th Amendment is neutral, and that discrimination of any kind that is adverse to any white person is precisely the same as discrimination that is adverse to a member of minorities. And you know, we could argue about that, but as a member of law, that as a matter of law, that is the case. Now, Justice Sotomayor, I think, doesn't really seek to disturb that part of the law, but she wants this court to take a closer look at why affirmative action may be needed. As we know, the Chief Justice has, and for many years has taken the position that, you know, really our racial problems are a thing of the past. We don't really need affirmative action. We don't really need Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. So we can sort of bring the court out of this whole area. In her dissent in a case called Schutte versus Coalition last term, Justice Sotomayor, for the first time as a justice, wrote very directly from the heart about what it was like to go to Princeton and then Yale Law School as a Puerto Rican, as part of affirmative action, and how important she thinks that is to progress for people like her.
And she read her dissent from the bench as well. It's all well documented in that chapter about what's called Justice of Hearts, Justice Sonia Sotomayor. Garrett Epps is the author of the book American Justice 2014, Nine Clashing Visions on the Supreme Court, about the last term of the Supreme Court. We can take more phone calls and emails on the other side of a break. Back with Garrett Epps and you in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the journalist and lawyer and law professor Garrett Epps, whose work appears in The Atlantic and The American Prospect, and now between the covers of a book in American Justice 2014, Nine Clashing Visions on the Supreme Court. It's actually his second book, and it's about the Supreme Court term that began in October of 2013. Nine chapters, justice by justice, case by case, and some of the really interesting cases that emerged from that court. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area, 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. There's a chapter here on Antonin Scalia, obviously. Empathy for the devil. Explain the devil references in the beginning of this chapter.
Well, Justice Scalia has always been a genius at stealing the spotlight. He believes he, as we say in the South, he ought to be the corpse at every funeral and the bride at every wedding. And at the beginning of the last term of court, on the weekend before, he managed to get an interview printed in New York Magazine in which he, more or less out of the blue, he hadn't been asked, but more or less out of the blue, he said, "I believe in the devil." And then he began going off on the interviewer about who's, because he said she didn't, and that, you know, he was an ordinary American with real religious faith, and she was a corrupt elite, and so forth. So that the term starts with people looking at him and saying, you know, okay, you believe in the devil, that makes you special and wonderful, I suppose. But in addition to that, there's a way in which Justice Scalia plays the part of the devil on the court. And by devil, I don't mean, you know, the seat of all evil, but I mean the kind of comic opera figure of a Mr. Punch show, that he comes on stage and says things that he know will get people screaming and hissing and booing, and he sort of looks at the audience and winks, you know, it's like, I'm so bad.
It's like twirling his mustache.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, really, you know, he is the Snidely Whiplash of the Supreme Court, if you will. And that playing that role the year before, not this past term, but the year before, in his dissent in the Windsor case, in which he just let fly and said, this court has clearly decided to hold for gay marriage, and everything they've written will mean that gay marriage is inevitable, really, I think, was a mistake. Because he thinks that gay marriage should not be required under the Constitution. And that opinion has now been cited by the lower court judges who have held that same-sex marriage is required by the Constitution. You know, he I think, thinks, maybe has thought twice about that. And fascinating in the last week, Jeff, that the first court of appeals in the country to uphold a ban on same-sex marriage, the Sixth Circuit issued an opinion by Judge Sutton, who is very well thought of, conservative judge, who had been a clerk to Justice Scalia, and his opinion makes no mention of Justice Scalia's dissent in the Windsor case, because I think it's embarrassing. I think it's an outburst. It's sort of like your uncle at the Thanksgiving dinner table who begins going on and on about something he has heard on Fox News, and everyone just falls silent until he's done, and then we return the conversation to talking about the Green Bay Packers, because it's embarrassing.
And you mentioned, too, that the Judge Alito actually mocks Scalia?
Alito, you know, is a fascinating character on the court. He is clearly a rival to Justice Scalia as the brains of the conservative wing, and he thinks Justice Scalia's whole originalist philosophy is really pretty silly. He thinks that we decide cases on present needs and on what the state of the law is today. So that at one point, Justice Scalia, there was a case testing whether California could make it a crime to sell violent video games to young people. And Justice Scalia was asking the lawyer about James Madison and the First Amendment. And Alito just interrupts him, and he says, I think what Justice Scalia wants to know is, how did James Madison feel about video games? Did he enjoy playing them? And, of course, the courtroom breaks up. Justice Scalia did not think it was funny. But it just shows that there is a difference of opinion. You know, this five-member conservative bloc on the Supreme Court is a very diverse group with their own opinions. And Justice Scalia's philosophy, which dominated that conservative dialogue for a generation, is really passing out of fashion.
Well, and when you get to the chapter on Alito as well, we're talking about Harris versus Quinn, which was a case about the limits to union powers. Is there anybody saying out loud, either on paper or in arguments of the Supreme Court, that the power of big money grows in politics while there are new limits on union power at the very same time?
Well, this point is beginning to be made, but you know, it's really as far as making the argument to the court. That would only be worth doing if you thought it was an accident. I think that Justice Alito really is not particularly reticent about the fact that there is a partisan motive behind this, that he believes that public employee unions are a negative force in our national life. Justice Kennedy has said much the same thing. They need to be cut back because they are expanding the size of government. We need to cut back the size of government. So there's really no pretense, you know, of neutrality between corporations and unions on the part of the conservatives on the court. And they believe that rich individuals and rich corporations not only have more influence, but that they should. That's the way democracy ought to work. These are the people who have succeeded. These are the people who have something to contribute, the rich, and they should have more influence than the rest of us. Whereas unions, they see as illegitimate structures that are, you know, created by the Democrats.
So money not only equals speech, it also equals virtue in their eyes?
Yes.
Wow. We have an email here from Stan in Ashland saying, given that judicial review, when he puts the term in quotes, is not in the Constitution, how do, here again, quotes, originalists justify their deciding the constitutionality of laws?
Well, I think that's a wonderful question. We need to look carefully because judicial review of a sort is in the Constitution, and that is the Article 6, Section 2, which clearly suggests that courts should review state laws to make sure they don't violate the federal Constitution. Judicial review by the federal courts of acts of Congress really is not in the text of the Constitution. That in itself doesn't prove anything because the text of the Constitution doesn't have a lot of things in it. It was written in a great hurry and isn't necessarily to be treated as holy writ. It was considered for a number of generations to be a reason why the federal courts should use that power sparingly, right? That it is something that is implied by the structure of the Constitution and also by statements from the founding generation. I mean, you can see these statements at the Philadelphia Convention, in which Madison and others say, well, remember, the courts will have the power to set aside federal laws if they're unconstitutional. But it is no longer viewed that way. This court will strike down, and the Rehnquist Court used to strike down in one term, you know, more laws than were struck down between 1915 and 1937 combined. That really, federal law really has become the focus of constitutional judicial review. And a lot of people try to warn the court that perhaps they're getting a little carried away with it, abusing a power that they probably ought to have.
Well, which raises the question that you do get into in the book as well, which is the discussion of judicial activism, which seems to be decried loud and long by conservatives when it goes to liberal ends, mm-hmm. but is unremarked upon when it goes to conservative ends.
Well, you know, I have a saying, and I teach my students that a judicial activist is an originalist with five votes, and each side sees the other as being activist when they reach a result they don't like. And I think we need a more useful discussion of what the term really ought to mean. I think that when you see a court reaching out to decide an issue, as the court arguably did in Citizens United, and deciding on the basis of things that have not been briefed or argued, you then have a right to question whether the court is really acting like a court. And that particular set of questions, it doesn't depend on whether the result is liberal or conservative. It has to do with courts acting like courts. And this court sometimes has not acted like a court.
So what in Citizens United came in from outside? What was used to make decisions that was not briefed or argued?
Well, what happened was the case came before the court, you know, as really a question about how a federal statute ought to be applied to a specific piece of campaign expenditure, a video called Hillary the Movie. And the court itself redefined the case and said, we want to decide on the constitutionality of the entire statute and on the question of whether you can forbid corporations and unions from engaging in these expenditures.
So here again, it could have been a narrow decision and they made it much broader.
Absolutely. I think it would have been very easy to write the decision to say, no, this movie that is available on pay-per-view video, this is not the kind of expenditures that the McCain-Feingold Act was aimed at. The McCain-Feingold Act was aimed at these massive broadcast advertising campaigns by dark money groups. And so you could have said, we will consider that question when it comes before the court, so that people would have had the opportunity to brief it and so forth. And instead, they put it down for re-argument on a hurried basis. It was re-argued actually in September. The court usually doesn't even sit until October because they were in such a rush to get to the result that clearly was in the cards. And it was distressing, not just because I think it's the wrong result. I think they misread the Constitution. But it was distressing because I think courts should act more deliberately. The issue wasn't going away. They could have decided it another term.
While we're on the issue of campaign spending and campaign behavior, Clarence Thomas's chapters about the Susan B. Anthony List versus Driehaus case, ultimately this gets down to whether it's a crime to lie in campaign ads, and what was the court's decision?
Well, the court itself didn't decide the underlying issue because really all they were asked to say was, could this group, this anti-abortion group, Susan B. Anthony List, could they bring a lawsuit to get the law set aside? And the lower court had said they couldn't bring the lawsuit because they said they were worried that this law that made it a crime to tell to say something false about a political candidate. Susan B. Anthony List said they were worried it would be applied against them if they criticized Democratic politicians for voting for Obamacare. And the lower court said, well, you say that that's true, that your criticism is true, so you have no standing to question the law unless you are willing to admit here and now that you're going to lie. So it was a kind of a catch-22. And the Supreme Court said, no, you know, go ahead and hear the lawsuit. Right? That's all they said. They didn't decide the underlying issue. And very quietly, a few months ago, the court in Ohio held the statute unconstitutional, as I think they should have.
All right. So since you mentioned Obamacare, I do want to make sure we go a little off book here and talk about this new case that the Supreme Court has agreed to hear that is seen as a major threat to the Affordable Care Act. Well, how do you see that setting up?
Well, I think there's been a lot of concern and consternation over the since the grant of cert in that case last week, because there seemed to be no reason for it. There's another case pending in front of the D.C. Circuit that was going to be held on December 17th. There's no split among the circuits at present. And the court was being urged in very political terms by conservative groups to take this Fourth Circuit case and just make the decision that will basically send the Affordable Care Act into a death spiral, basically for political reasons, that it's a bad statute and this is our chance to stop it, and we need the court to do it because Congress won't repeal the statute. The grant of cert is very distressing to people. Linda Greenhouse, who is really the dean of Supreme Court reporters and commentators, had a piece in the New York Times today saying basically that after a generation of working at the court and saying that she believed that the justices were trying to do law, she said, "I surrender. They are just politicians in robes." So the signs are very bad. The signs are that this court majority, which has a lot of trouble saying no to the Republican Party in partisan cases, is going to take down the Affordable Care Act so that the Republicans in Congress won't have their fingers on it. And I am very distressed by it, and I know a lot of other people are too. Maybe that won't happen. Maybe at the last minute one of them will turn back. But the signs aren't good.
Did John Roberts surprise you when he turned back and made the decision, the deciding vote in favor of keeping Obamacare's mandate constitutional?
No, he didn't, to be honest, because I think if you were there for the argument, you saw him talking about the tax issue, you saw him challenging the other side and saying, how can you say this isn't a tax? It's clearly a tax. And I think his decision was correct. And I think the four dissenters were wrong. And I think their decision is very poor. So I'm not surprised when a smart justice gets the law right. I'm surprised when they get it wrong.
Well, the book is a really interesting look at the Supreme Court from the inside. American Justice 2014. Some terrific writing in here, Garrett Epps. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it.
All right, take care.